Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, September 28th. 2023. City of Pecos files lawsuit over property tied to Presidio County Attorney Rod Ponton. By Sam Karras, Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Pecos. On August 25th, the City of Pecos filed a lawsuit against Wilmar Land, LLC, and 124 South Oak Street, LLC, the latter of which is filed under Big Bend Law, the private practice of Presidio County Attorney Rod Ponton. The suit claims that a property in downtown Pecos was unlawfully sold by the city in 2021 to Joe McFadden of Wilmar Land, during which time Ponton was Pecos city attorney, who in turn sold the property to an LLC belonging to Ponton in 2022. Because the sale violated statutory requirements governing the sale of city land, the suit argues, the sale should be rendered void. At a meeting on January 28, 2021, Pecos Council members approved a resolution that would sell the property to Wilmar Land, LLC, for $35,000. Ponton was the City of Pecos attorney at the time of the sale to Wilmar, and had also been city attorney when the property was originally purchased from the West of the Pecos Museum. Ponton told the Big Bend Sentinel that he had nothing to do with the sale, which he claims was negotiated between McFadden and the then city manager. In the petition filed with the 143rd District Court, current City of Pecos attorney Parker Johnson argues that sale never should have happened. By ordinance, city-owned property must be bought and sold by a set process. The property must be posted in the newspaper and open for public bid. McFadden, whose Wilmar Land LLC also owns property in Brewster County, said that then-city manager Seth Sorensen approached him about buying the property in Pecos. The building on the property was in a dilapidated state and in danger of being torn down. The city wanted to fix it up, but dragged their feet for a few years, he said, and Sorensen knew that I was looking at properties over there. Sorensen submitted the resolution to City Council authorizing the sale, which was then approved by a vote before the property could be publicly posted for bid. He could not be reached for comment. A little over a year later, McFadden suffered a stroke and had to return home to recuperate. To lighten his load, he sold the property to Ponton. I love Pecos and I wanted to stay, but the stroke changed everything in my life, McFadden said. Both McFadden and Ponton said that properties had been sold in Pecos through the city council without going out for public bid, many times before, and didn't understand why they should be treated any differently. There are properties on the same street that have been sold the same way, Ponton said. The suit argues that because the city did not follow its own ordinance, the sale of the land to McFadden, and thus the transfer of the land to Ponton, was unlawful, and that the resulting deeds were void. The sale of the property from the City of Pecos was done in violation of the statutory requirements for sale of property by municipalities, the petition reads. If the suit is successful, ownership of the 118 South Oak Street property will be returned to the City of Pecos, and the city will also be reimbursed for attorney fees. Ponton claimed that the suit was just dirty politics, and that transferring the deed back to the city would violate Texas property law. You shouldn't involve a city in the legal system on the basis of a bogus claim, he said. Photo by Chad Wadsworth. This year's Trans-Pecos Festival of Music Plus Love will be the last at El Cosmico's current location, as preparations for a move and expansion are underway. Trans-Pecos Festival begins final run at current location as El Cosmico looks to the future. By Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. This week, beginning on Thursday, the 17th Annual Trans-Pecos Festival of Music Plus Love will kick off at the El Cosmico Campground along U.S. 67, just south of city limits, as it has every year prior. Next year, as every Marfa local knows, is a different story. The nomadic hotel that has become a hub of picturesque tourist visits, with its Instagrammable tents and yurts, will have relocated across town, with considerably expanded offerings and accommodations. Trans-Pecos, of course, will go with it, making this year a send-off of sorts from its birthplace. But El Cosmico founder Liz Lambert stresses that the festival will stay true to its roots. She has no intention of dramatically increasing ticket sales, she says, if at all. We don't want to be Lollapalooza, said Lambert in an interview with the Big Ben Sentinel, referencing the famed Chicago Music Festival that draws around 400,000 annual attendees. We understand where we are. Trans-Pecos caps its ticket sales at 1,500. That includes ticket sales to locals, in large part because Marfa's infrastructure can only support so many visitors at a time. But it's also the case that what is born out of necessity has become the festival's trademark charm. Visiting musicians have been drawn to the relative intimacy of the event compared to larger venues. Part of what's beautiful about it is how small it is, said Lambert. So she plans to keep it small, even as the venue itself gets larger. In March of this year, Lambert announced her ambitious plan to relocate the outdoor resort to a swath of land triple its current size off Antelope Hills Road. The plan includes the construction of 3D-printed hotel units, a restaurant, a swimming pool, and a bathhouse, plus 30 to 40 3D-printed homes along the outskirts of the property. Between the 3D-printed accommodations and the relocated tents and yurts from the old site, the new El Cosmico will include around 120 hotel units, roughly doubling its current number of units. The announcement has elicited some concerns from locals, particularly those who live in or near the Antelope Hills subdivision, about the impacts the development and accompanying traffic may have on the area's water infrastructure, roads, noise pollution, and more. Most recently, the question of how best to divert hotel traffic from the poorly maintained Antelope Hills Road has been a topic of discussion at Presidio County Commissioners' Court meetings. A proposal to put a road through Vizcaino Park as an alternative, recently presented at court, has been met with resistance by some. Liz Lambert herself was present at Wednesday's Commissioners' Court meeting to advocate for the plan, which would pull traffic away from Antelope Hills Road and onto the state-maintained FM 1112, and provide an easement through the park. In response to fears the road would interfere with the park, she said she hopes the plan leads to its revitalization. County Commissioner David Beebe, who first placed the proposal on the agenda, said his concern was monetary. Antelope Hills Road is a county-run Antelope Hills Road is county-run and difficult to maintain. Diverting traffic to the state-maintained highway would keep heavy traffic off of Antelope Hills and would be in the county's best interest. We have a budget crisis, and the reason I'm concerned about this project at all is we have a budget crisis that's going to get worse every year, said Beebe on Wednesday. Though the plan to relocate El Cosmico is steadily moving forward, the sale of the land has closed, and the team still anticipates breaking ground in early 2024. These questions around infrastructure are still being explored, said Lambert. Road access aside, her team is still in talks with the city of Marfa about potentially extending water supply to the site. Residents had been concerned about impacts to their wells, but with no resolution. The Trans-Pecos Festival is inherently a part of these discussions. Though not El Cosmico's primary reason for being, it is the event that draws the most visitors to the grounds annually. By extension, it brings in some of the largest crowds that Marfa sees all year. The festival has grown considerably since its early days. In fact, said Lambert, the inaugural Trans-Pecos was really more of a party, with just around 200 guests. They had passed out flyers to neighbors to rally attendees. It was in the early days of El Cosmico when she was toying around with different ideas for hotel units. She had concocted a plan to help fund the project by drawing folks to an event where they could opt to buy renovated trailers as condos. That plan quickly got thrown to the wayside, she said, but the party remained. El Cosmico has grown organically since those early days, she said, distinct from her other hotel projects. In this case, because we've been able to add teepees or yurts or different sorts of dwelling structures over the years, we've just been able to grow the footprint over the years, she said. I mean, we really did begin with two trailers. As the resort and the annual festival has grown in size, it has in some ways remained the same. The relative smallness of the festival not only has a regular cast of local musicians who turn up to play, but keeps bringing out regular visitors to its stages. We have many musicians who come play the festival every year, which is unusual, and stay for several days. Most music festivals, most of the time people are in and out really quickly, said Lambert. We're not trying to recreate Trans-Pecos, she added. It serves us well for what it is. If it's not broke, I don't think we should try to fix it. Ben Queller performs at last year's Trans-Pecos Festival. The musician will perform again at this year's festival on Thursday. Photo by Chad Wadsworth. Fort Davis ISD partners with private early childhood schools for funding boost. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Fort Davis. With public school funding in a state of turmoil across Texas, Fort Davis ISD is turning to an unorthodox solution to increase state aid. Partnerships with early childhood programs, wherein dual enrollment is meant to financially benefit both entities. Superintendent Graydon Hicks, who has long told of his district's financial ruin at the hand of a flawed state funding formula, said he first became aware of the private school partnerships, a Texas Education Agency program, this summer, and immediately jumped on it and started working on proposals for these organizations. For Fort Davis, it is the only option left. The school board understands how much this means to Fort Davis and keeping our doors open and our kids serviced, said Hicks. We get the satisfaction on the other side of knowing that some other children are reaping benefits from this as well. This school year, FDISD entered into one-year renewable legal agreements with both Alpine Christian School and Alpine Montessori, as well as schools in Monahans and El Paso. These schools enroll pre-kindergarten through second-grade students who aren't subject to state testing, simplifying the deal with FDISD, and in turn get 50% of the additional state aid the district receives for those students. They don't have to start wearing green and gold. They don't have to have the Indian mascot, said Hicks. Nothing changes. Literally, nothing changes except for paperwork. At the start of the school year, FDISD had around 167 students enrolled, but Hicks anticipates that number will nearly double to around 300 students by the end of October, once new partnerships are finalized. That influx in enrollment will not result in more children physically entering Fort Davis classrooms, but will allow the district to receive the state minimum allotment per pupil of $6,160, or in some cases for 3- and 4-year-olds, just over $3,000. Attendance is another state funding factor, and private schools who partner with FDISD will have to provide daily attendance reports, said Hicks. Alpine Montessori plans to enroll 28 students with FDISD, which could result in roughly $172,000 total, or a $86,000 split for each entity. Katie Nixon, an Alpine Montessori board member, said in addition to the funds, the entity was looking forward to having access to more teacher training and resources for students. The district may also help purchase technology or supplies for the private schools. Alpine Christian School declined to be interviewed for this story, citing the newness of the partnership. For Fort Davis, the current addition of 133 students could result in $400,000. But it will be a year before any money is realized due to TEA's funding cycles, said Hicks. Any surplus received will initially go towards building the district's fund balance or savings account back up, as well as teacher salary increases, said Hicks. In FDISD's case, the increase in enrollment may result in the district no longer being subject to recapture payments the district makes to the state because it is considered to have, quote, excess wealth, end quote, per student, a result of low enrollment coinciding with high property values. Last school year, the district paid around $30,000 in recapture. As far as Hicks is concerned, the private school partnership solution is a win-win. We get a little money, they get a little money. We get out of recapture, and the state pays their fair share, said Hicks. He said at first the partnership organizations he approached questioned the initiative's legality, but he assured them it was a state-supported program. According to the TEA, 174 districts across the state utilized the Early Learning Public-Private Partnerships program, which began in 2003. All of the organizations on the initial call were skeptical that this was a legitimate program, said Hicks. They couldn't believe that there was actually a way to secure money without all of the bureaucratic red tape and requirements. But the partnerships aren't without their complications. Despite the fact that these transactions are not affecting classroom operations, in order to meet required student-to-teacher ratios, FDISD will have to hire staff from partner organizations, effectively adding them to their payroll, even though they are not physically working within the district and will remain with private schools. They will also have to do evaluations on staff they hire in collaboration with the private schools where they actually work. The money for their salaries and benefits will come out of the private school's 50% split, as would any supply purchases, said Hicks. But while FDISD absorbing a staff member will result in cost savings immediately for the private school, the district has to pick up that expense before increased enrollment funds are realized next fall. Hicks said he recently submitted documentation to TEA requesting additional cash flow to remedy the issue. I'm not going to lie to you, it's a real challenge, said Hicks. I'm saying I need TEA to adjust my numbers up because I'm really going to be closer to 300 on my attendance projection, and I need the additional funding now so that I can keep my cash flow solvent until we get to the settlement period next September. If they say no, then I'm going to have a problem, Hicks added, but I promise you I'll figure it out. There is also the matter of special education and English as a second language, ESL, students, who require more resources, therefore receive more funding from the state. Hicks said the early childhood private school partnerships they are entering into will include a couple of students in those populations. FDISD will be legally obligated to provide certain services to those students, which would involve going to the private schools where the kids are located, said Hicks. When asked whether that would put a strain on FDISD resources and staffing, Hicks said details are still being worked out, and while meeting those requirements for students in Alpine may be feasible, it would not be for students involved in El Paso school partnerships. I'm not going to mess around with failing to provide services that these kids require, said Hicks. On the flip side, since these are private schools, they can choose who they want to enroll as well. Let's say we have a special ed child in El Paso that's going to require a great deal of resources. My recommendation to those parents and to that private school would be, don't enroll that child in Fort Davis. Enroll that child in the school district in which they reside, he added. Whether FDISD will be able to sustain these partnerships remains to be seen. Hicks said all the responsibility to keep up with state requirements falls on him, and he intends to make the agreements as easy as possible on the collaborating schools. Alpine ISD Superintendent Michelle Reinhardt recently told the Alpine Avalanche that AISD was open to partnering with local early childhood programs as well. Alpine Montessori told the Big Bend Sentinel it plans to partner with AISD for the 2024 school year. While the partnerships differ from the school choice program, the controversial, hotly debated subject of a forthcoming special legislative session, in structure, at the core, they both involve valuable public education dollars funneling into private school coffers. A similarity, Hicks believes, gives the private school partnerships political staying power. That's why I don't think anybody can say anything about it, said Hicks, because the leadership in Austin right now are so bent on school vouchers. If there's public money going to private school, they're not going to say anything about that. They're going to cheer that. They're going to support that. Alpine Humane Society donations down 50%, resulting in service cuts. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Tri-County. Donations to the Alpine Humane Society, AHS, which help keep the animal welfare nonprofit afloat, have recently declined by about 50% since this time last year, resulting in cuts to payroll, downsizing of office space, and the elimination of critical low-cost spay and neuter clinics. The mobile clinics, coined the Big Bend Big Fix program, started in 2020 and served around 2,000 animals throughout the region, before shuttering due to lack of funds in May, according to Janine Bishop, executive director of AHS. Now, in the absence of an affordable, convenient option for spaying and neutering pets, Bishop said the area is once again experiencing swells in animal populations resulting from puppy and kitten season this past spring. Just the explosion in the animal population, it's heartbreaking because we had been making strides, said Bishop. We were actually seeing a dent in the homeless pet population and the feral cat colony populations. With many local shelters routinely at capacity, there is often nowhere for unwanted animals to go. Facebook posts in local groups requesting help housing abandoned dogs or cats are omnipresent. The area's lack of resources puts people that do choose to take on additional animals in a tough position, said Bishop. It's nothing for us to get contacted by people with 15 cats, 10 dogs, situations where things have gotten out of hand because people hadn't been able to afford things, and now it's even worse because we can't help them, said Bishop. Bishop estimates the Big Bend Big Fix clinics served up to 200 animals a weekend when up and running, offering not only steeply discounted spay and neuter services compared to local veterinarian prices, but administering vaccinations for common diseases such as rabies, parvo, distemper, and feline leukemia, as well as microchips. But each clinic costs the Humane Society $30,000 to put on, and costs continued to increase, starting at $45 per procedure in 2020 and climbing to $150 over time. AHS was asking pet owners to pay what they could and subsidizing the rest, which became unsustainable as gas prices and inflation continued to rise, said Bishop. There were also costly repairs to an AHS van as various funding streams began to dry up. We're really in danger of not making it, said Bishop. Our coalition partners, a lot of them are in the same boat. They're having to turn people away, turn people down, carrying huge balances from the local vets on their accounts, which is hard on the local vets and their businesses. As it stands, AHS is only able to pay the minimum on their credit card balances, which they use to pay bills from local vets. Bishop took herself off of payroll recently as a cost-cutting measure. She said AHS's grant opportunities are limited, and while they received a $30,000 grant from the Permian Basin Area Foundation recently, they are unable to apply for another for 2 years. The nonprofit does benefit from a $1 million trust gifted to them by a benefactor, but the way the trust is structured allows AHS to receive interest on the dividends from the stocks invested. Their latest quarterly distributions were some of the lowest they have ever received, said Bishop. It has never provided us more than $60,000 in a year, explained Bishop. Our budget has been in the range of $300,000 a year. Support can be provided to the Alpine Humane Society and its programs by shopping at their thrift store in Alpine, becoming a monthly donor, or through legacy giving, said Bishop. The organization has recently partnered with local bars in Alpine, which agreed to host happy hours with a portion of the proceeds going to AHS. This Saturday, September 29th, AHS will host a burger basket benefit at Skelton's Runway, 300 South Cockrell Street, from 5 p.m. until sold out. The cost is $12 a plate. The venue, as well as food from Porter's and Far West Texas Cattle Company, have been donated. AHS hopes to raise $2,000 through the event. Bishop said, for now, AHS plans to hang on, hoping for a lifeline in the form of economic improvement or a generous donor. In the future, AHS plans to emphasize disseminating public information about pet ownership and its costs. There isn't always some safety net out there, said Bishop. Before you take on a pet, or you take in those five strays that were walking down your road, things like that, we want to educate people. For more information, visit alpinehumanesociety.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan Snooze for Thursday, September 21st. School board texts point to open meeting violation. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A pair of meetings divided between different members of the school board to discuss the school district's hair policy was definitely a violation of the Texas Open Meetings Act, according to attorney Bill Aylshire, who, among other areas of his practice, advises news organizations on open meetings and public information issues. After learning of the meetings through anonymous sources, the news filed a public information request with the Monahans Wicket Pyote Independent School District, MWPISD, requesting communications, including cell phone texts, of school board members and Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith. The body of those messages, printed below, confirmed that the meetings were deliberately called in such a way as to try and skirt around the requirements of the Texas Open Meetings Act, in this case by creating a walking quorum. Smith said in a prepared statement to the news, quote, "The sole intent of the meeting was to give the principals an opportunity to let the board members know how frustrated they were with dealing constantly with the dress code, especially hair." Quote, "The board is a vital part of our administrative team, and from time to time in the past, some have been invited to principal meetings, and that is exactly what this meeting was, a principal's meeting, not a board meeting." End quote. Smith advised the board members via text messaging that more than one meeting was necessary, with only three members present at each meeting, and said members could not discuss what was talked about in the meetings after leaving the meetings because it could constitute a walking quorum. Texas Government Code Section 551.143 states a walking quorum is when members engage in communications separately that, when taken together, would constitute a quorum. Having a quorum of members present invokes the requirements of the Texas Open Meetings Act. The act requires all meetings of governmental bodies be open to the public when discussing the public's business. The Texas Attorney General's Open Meetings Act handbook states, quote, "Amended Section 551.143 now prohibits discussion about an item of public business among a quorum of a governmental body through a series of communications. The new amendment became law in 2019. MWPISD School Board is comprised of seven voting members: Raymond Reyes, Donna Garcia, Bobby Almanza, Nancy Upchurch, Josh Schwab, Steve Fine, and Steve Tuxhorn, and a quorum consists of four members. In an email to the news on Monday, replying to the open records request for text messages between Smith and board members, Smith sent screenshots containing a group message to school board members. On August 19th, Smith sent a group text regarding the two meetings to be held the following day. Smith to group: Donna, Steve T., and Bobby are meeting with principals tomorrow at 10. Remember, you cannot discuss this or daisy chain info as it becomes a public meeting. If two or more of you could meet at 11 a.m., that would be great. The reason I don't want to just meet in a regular scheduled board meeting is because the paper will twist and turn and print the article as a board versus campus administration conflict. Bobby Amanza to group, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. Nancy Upchurch to group, I can meet whatever time. Just let me know soon so I do not plan something else at that time. Smith to group, 10 o'clock tomorrow, Bobby. Nancy Upchurch to group, so who is at 11 o'clock? I can go at 11 o'clock. Almanza to group, 10 o'clock, okay. Smith to group, Nancy, you come at 11 o'clock and see if maybe Raymond Steve F. can come at 11. Steve Tuxhorn to group, Tuxhorn can do either time slot, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. Nancy to group, Steve Fine, when can you go? Smith to group, I just know we can't have a quorum. Josh Schwab to group, I work out of town on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Aylshire, with Aylshire Law PC in Austin, and a member of the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas, the FOIFT, said, quote, my God, if this isn't a violation of the Open Meetings Act, then I don't know what is. The superintendent should really attend some training on open meetings. In the messages, he clearly confessed to conspiring with members of the school board, his bosses, to conduct a series of meetings that he knew would involve a quorum. The county attorney should look into the issue as a criminal violation, he said. A violation of the Open Meetings Act is a Class C misdemeanor, which could result in a fine of between $100 and $500, 1 to 6 months in jail, or both. School board members are required by the Texas Government Code to take open meetings training within 90 days of taking the oath of office. Smith apologized for breaking the law, saying, quote, there certainly was no intent to violate the OMA, Open Meeting Act, in any way. We are certainly not trying to hide anything or have secret meetings. Again, this was a meeting to let the principals inform board members of their frustrations. There was no agenda and no decisions made. The board members were invited in groups so that we would not break the OMA. If we inadvertently broke the act, I apologize and will learn from it and carry on. End quote. In phone calls last week to board members, Steve Fine, Steve Tuxhorn, Donna Garcia, and Nancy Upchurch all confirmed they were present for one of the two meetings held, but all said they were not aware by holding the two meetings in that manner was a violation of the Open Meetings Act. Raymond Reyes, Josh Schwab, and Bobby Almanza could not be contacted. Quote, the main reason behind the Texas Open Meeting Act is to allow citizens to stay informed about what decisions their governmental bodies are making and allowing them to decide if they should vote again for those elected to those positions, and this was an obvious violation, Aylshire added. Band trip, accountability, and security top school board. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Monahans Wicket Paiute ISD School Board met in regular session Monday in the administration building. The meeting was called to order. A quorum was established. Invocation was given by Raymond Reyes, and Board President Donna Garcia called on MHS Head Band Director Joe Barrow to present his request for the spring band trip to the board for approval. The trip, planned for May 29th, 30th, 31st, June 1st, and 2nd, will be to Disneyland, California. The band students will hold several fundraisers throughout the year to help defray the cost of $925 per student. Quote, we can save a substantial amount of money using Lobo buses instead of having to use charter buses like we did last year, Barrow said. Barrow presented a sample itinerary for the trip, which includes, on Wednesday, to eat and explore downtown Disney after checking into the hotel on Thursday, spend the day in Disneyland, Friday, spend the day in Disneyland, Saturday, go to Universal Studios, and travel home on Sunday. The board gave approval for the band trip next spring. Assistant Superintendent of Federal Programs Doug Doggie then presented information on the district's Domain 3 accountability standing. The domain accountability for a school district is based on STAR scores. Domain 1 and Domain 2 are state-level requirements. Domain 1 evaluates performance across all subjects for all students on both general and alternate assessments, college, career, and military readiness indicators, and graduation rates. State-level Domain 2 measures district and campus outcomes in two areas, the students that grew at least 1 year academically or are on track, as measured by STAR results, and the achievement of all students relative to districts or campuses with similar economically disadvantaged percentages. The federal-level Domain 3 uses disaggregated data to demonstrate differentials among racial and ethnic groups, socioeconomic backgrounds, and other factors. The indicators included in this domain, as well as the domain's construction, align the state accountability system with the Every Student Succeeds Act. Quote, we will not know our 2023 score until the government finishes the revisions in the accountability system, hopefully by the end of September or October, Doggie said. MWP ISD Superintendent Chad Smith gave the Board of Trustees the information on the acceptance of a $30,000 donation from Chevron to support career and technical education programs of study and pathways of development for MWP ISD. A short bond project update was presented by Smith. Quote, most everything is completed and being utilized. The elevator at the swimming pool is now working, but the elevator at the press box is not working yet. They have ordered a certain part 3 times, and each time the measurements were wrong. Maybe this time we'll be right, Smith said. Smith told the board the cafeteria, inside and outside eating areas, are functioning and are being utilized more as time goes on. Quote, I think students are finding out the food is good and costs less than at other places. They even have a yogurt machine, Smith said. Next up was an update on the district's emergency operations plan. Presented by Jeff Jones, the Assistant Superintendent of Support Services. Jones told the Board of Trustees that he meets with all branches of law enforcement and emergency services once a month. Quote, we all get together behind closed doors and spend 45 minutes to an hour discussing any safety issues we are aware of and how to correct them, Jones said. Anthony Agundis, Director of Special Education, headed a report to the board members on how pre-kindergarten to third-grade student reading and math skills will be tracked and recorded for a periodic comparison of progress. The teachers have progress sheets for each student to chart reading progress, sight word progress, and math skills. Daily, weekly, and monthly progress can be seen at a glance, and knowledge of areas needing improvement are easily recognizable. In other regular business attended to by the board, we're approving the minutes from the last meeting and approving the financial report. The board adjourned the public meeting to go into closed session to discuss accepting the resignation of diagnostician Donna Upchurch. According to Superintendent Secretary Gay Fisher, after reconvening into executive session, Upchurch's resignation was accepted and board member Nancy Upchurch, mother-in-law to Donna, abstained from the vote. Present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Josh Schwarb, Raymond Reyes, Donna Garcia, Steve Tuxhorn, Nancy Upchurch, and Chad Smith. Board Trustee Steve Fine was absent from the meeting. School board meetings are held on the third Monday of each month, making the next regularly scheduled meeting day October 16th at 6:30 in the Administration Building at 606 South Betty Street. Any individual who has a concern or question can request to be placed on the board meeting agenda. Anyone interested in addressing the Board of Trustees needs to pick up a registration form from the administration office. Individuals may only address issues which are listed on the agenda, which is posted 72 hours before the meeting day. They must be registered to speak by 12 noon on the day of the meeting and will have 4 minutes to speak. The public is encouraged to become involved in affairs concerning our students. Local pastor accused of sex crimes against children. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans pastor is being held on an $150,000 bond after he was arrested early last Sunday morning at his home on charges of sexual abuse of a child under age 14. Michael Henry Fickenshire, age 68, of 1305 South Kenneth Street, was picked up on a McAllen Police Department warrant at his home by officers of the Monahans Police Department. Monahans Police Department Chief of Police Christopher Quintana said, quote, McAllen requested our assistance in the arrest of Fickenshire on the active warrant, end quote. According to the Texas District Lutheran Church Missouri Synod website, Fickenshire has served as pastor for the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Monahans, located at 1500 South Stockton and Kermit since 1998. In 2011, both Alpine and Fort Stockton Lutheran churches were added to his ministry. A warrant was issued on September 14th after a report was made to the McAllen Police Department. It is alleged Fickenshire abused two of his grandchildren while they were visiting over summer vacation. A source close to the investigation told the news, quote, he wrote a letter to the four churches he serves and drove to all four churches with the following copies to be distributed on Sunday. In the letter, Fickenshire wrote, I will not be able to attend or conduct services tomorrow. I am not emotionally, physically, mentally, or spiritually able to do church tomorrow. However, everything necessary for the services will be located on the pulpit of each church. Obviously, there will be no communion tomorrow. There will be no Bible classes this week, as I will be out of town most of the week. Truthfully, Bible classes for the fall will more than likely be canceled. If I am able, I will attempt to explain more in a further email tomorrow, but right now I'm not up to it. I am sorry for this. God bless you. Pastor Mike. Phone calls to the Texas District LCMS were not returned as of press time. The news will update this story as information becomes available. Solution may be near for MEDC easement problems. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. At the end of the regularly scheduled Monahans Economic Development Corporation, the board convened an executive session at the end of the meeting to discuss real property, a 0.159 tract of land needed for an easement from Car Wash 828. After reconvening to open session, the board announced they agreed on a possible solution they are hopeful will end the ongoing easement saga with the car wash. MEDC has been at odds with Car Wash 828 over the easement sought across part of the property which is owned by the car wash since last October. The easement is necessary in order to connect new sewer lines for future commercial development into the established main sewer city line that is located on the car wash property. Director Ashley Adalto said, quote, "The board agreed to a proposal which states if the easement is granted, the MEDC will make sure the car wash continues to have access to city dumpster services through the construction and development of MEDC commercial properties," end quote. Currently, there is no alleyway where the dumpster is located, so the city has been allowed access through an adjacent MEDC property to the car wash's dumpster, Adalto added. MEDC has been trying to obtain the easement from the car wash since last October. It wasn't clear as of press time if the car wash accepted the proposal. In other agenda items, the board heard a presentation from Senior Account Executive Terry Munoz with Pacer.ai, a locations analytics company that collects geolocation from cell phones and able to share data anonymously about services they provide and to hear of what benefit it could be to the EDC. During the last meeting, the board was tasked with approving a software data contract with the company, but the item was tabled pending some outreach and more information. MEDC Director Ashley Adalto asked Munoz to brief the board on the data analytic company. The company uses location analytics to analyze foot traffic using Wi-Fi, beacons, cameras, thermal sensors, and GPS because foot traffic data is behavioral, meaning it shows actions, not opinions. Quote, "We are using mobile data to provide the market intelligence on any location, any site, anywhere, by using our own panel of more than 30 million mobile devices," Munoz told the group. Munoz added, "They do not know who is in the panel. There is no contact made, and no one is tracked." Quote, "It is all done by the mobility of the device, tablets, phone, or watches, on a 24/7 basis, automized with no personal information," he said. Information collected by third parties, Facebook, Twitter, Apple, or Android, are not used due to privacy. Quote, "We think there are some privacy concerns as to where the data comes from with these companies," Munoz said. The company knows the mobility of a device through dozens of application location partners who send the information anonymously. Munoz added, "There are over 2,700 customers and 700 Civics clients using this platform. Cost is based on population and is approximately $15,000 per year." Adalto told the board she would rather peruse a contract with Retail Strategies or the Retail Coach for them to create a study on Monahan's and then move forward with them as a consultant. Adalto told the board, quote, "Retail Strategies currently works with Pecos EDC, and if projects come up for this area, they would go to Pecos over Monahan's," end quote. The item was informational only, and the board took no action, and Adalto said she would get more information from the Retail Coach to present to the board. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable totaling $52,000, which included $6,800 for payroll salaries, $40,000 to Amerigroup for the Flume revision, and $1,100 for the survey on the 1200 South Stockton property. The financial report, reflecting a balance of $2.8 million in available funds as of August 31st, and minutes of the August 21st meeting were approved. Directors present were Hal Upchurch, Richard Irwin, Leticia Rodriguez, Kathy Anthony, and Mary Elena Sines. Therapists Certified in New Technique. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Ward Memorial Hospital has stepped up to another level of physical therapy techniques being offered to Monahans and area patients. Kelsey Dogie, PT, Homer Peak, PTA, and Cruz Morales, PTA, have become certified in the Graston technique, which is using specifically shaped metal instruments designed to fit and be applied to different body parts and body shapes. The Graston technique is Instrument Assist Soft Tissue Mobilization, IASTM for short. The process falls between hand massage therapy and chiropractic manipulation. Dogie, Peak, and Morales are the only certified Graston technique physical therapists within a 100-mile radius of WMH. An Odessa doctor has referred a patient to the physical therapy unit at WMH to receive this specific therapy. An amateur athlete, a machinist by trade, created this technique after becoming frustrated by a debilitating knee injury. He pursued surgery and physical therapy and still did not achieve the results he wanted. He put his professional skills to work and created a set of tools to aid in soft tissue work. To his surprise, the tools provided a much-needed level of relief. This led him to collaborate with medical professionals to further develop these instruments and research the techniques for each one's used. The technique is a form of instrument-assisted soft tissue mobilization to gauge and tend to scar tissue, fascia, and other conditions that can often lead to pain. The official definition of IASTM is, quote, the use of instruments or tools to assist with the identification and or treatment of movement dysfunction caused by pain or changes to the soft tissue structures. The technique is performed by a skilled therapist using handheld stainless steel tools as they administer a series of strokes at specific pressures to the body's soft tissue in the affected areas. This type of therapy can provide a mobilizing effect on scar tissue and fascia, which can lead to decreased pain and increased range of motion. The tools and technique provides a deeper penetration into the tissue and allows for a more specific treatment versus traditional massage. GT is designed to break up scar tissue, improve blood flow in order to decrease inflammation and improve recovery. The treatment is used by 2/3 of professional sports teams and can be used to treat several common conditions such as ankle pain, wrist pain, neck pain, fibromyalgia, hamstring injuries, hip pain, IT band, tennis elbow, back pain, golfer's elbow, knee pain, heel pain, shoulder pain, scar tissue, trigger finger, women's health, and more. Quote, Physicians can search online for Graston Technique, and our Ward Memorial Hospital comes up as the place to come to, Peake said. Doege added, quote, "We can work on as young as one-year-olds. We work to help strengthen their muscles for proper development. Sometimes babies will favor one position where they hold their heads tilted and cause the muscles on the short side to become weakened. We can work to help them hold their heads up straight. We can also work with spina bifida babies, as well as help with a baby's mobility and motor development. Babies are supposed to be sitting up at 6 months old, pulling up at 11 months, and walking alone by 18 months. The Graston technique can be a valuable treatment in many cases. All three therapists are fully certified in Level 1 and Level 2 treatment, and every 2 years will go to classes for recertification.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.